Good afternoon and welcome to the Cato Institute. For those of you who don't know me, I'm David Bowes. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Institute here, and it's my honor to preside over our event today. This week, as you know, we're celebrating the 300th birthday of Benjamin Franklin, though it seems to me we're not celebrating enough. I've been looking in the papers and saying, where's the style section profile in the Washington Post? Where's the White House ceremony? Nevertheless, there are a number of books being published this season about Benjamin Franklin, and there have been some newspaper articles. In the Washington Post article that some of you may have seen that quoted Mark Skousen, the Associated Press reminds us that Benjamin Franklin was, quote, a businessman, inventor, revolutionary, athlete. Franklin is a member of the United States Swim School Association Hall of Fame. Diplomat, publisher, humorist, sage, man of destiny, and regular guy. In the New York Times, one of Franklin's biographers, Stacy Schiff, points out that Franklin signed every document central to America's founding. She also notes, the most read writer in colonial America, Franklin found that only the Bible outsold his almanacs. The former, he reasoned, you bought once. The latter had to be purchased annually. And it's that sense of business that may point to one of the reasons he doesn't get as much respect as he might. The distinguished historian Gordon Wood told the Associated Press, for a long time, most intellectuals saw him as a spokesman for capitalism and for making money and getting ahead, a view of America many have had. And, of course, that's just what intellectuals didn't like about both Franklin and the country he helped to invent. Well, our speaker today, Mark Skousen, likes capitalism and America and Benjamin Franklin. As many of you know, Mark is an economist, an investment advisor, and a prolific author. He writes a newsletter, Forecasts and Strategies. He has served as president of the Foundation for Economic Education and taught economics at the Columbia Business School. His previous books include Economics on Trial, The Making of Modern Economics, and Vienna and Chicago, Friends or Foes. He is also, he tells me, an eighth-generation descendant of Benjamin Franklin, which explains his interest in today's topic. Franklin's autobiography is one of the great American books, read by many a schoolboy and girl over the years. But unfortunately, the autobiography stops in 1757, on the eve of Franklin's great achievements in statesmanship. So today, Mark will tell us how he completed Benjamin Franklin's autobiography by adding materials that Franklin wrote over the course of his life about his experiences in his personal life, his public life, and so on. Mark will discuss the book, then we'll take some questions, and it'll be available for signing afterward. And Mark wanted me to let you know that if you buy it here today, in addition to the book, you will get an authentic antique American stamp with Benjamin Franklin's picture on it. So please welcome the compiler and editor of the completed autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, Mark Skousen.
David, thank you very much. I should tell you that when Franklin made an interesting statement about individuals who boast of a famous ancestor. He said, he that boasts of a famous ancestor doth but advertise his own insignificance. So I'm a little bit concerned about that, so maybe I won't play up that role too much. I would like to make a contribution in economics and finance, and I do write an investment newsletter, so I'm following in the footsteps to some extent of Franklin. I wanted to first talk about why I wrote this book. I think it's an important thing that you see what I've tried to do here, because it's probably the most exciting project I've been involved in as far as writing is concerned. And as David said, the autobiography, which I have a copy of here, this is the Yale University Press copy, was very incomplete. I mean, every autobiography to some extent is incomplete. Very few write the last words of an autobiography and then die the next day. So there's always a period of time where they haven't written about it. But in Franklin's case, it's egregious. It's 33 years. The first 51 years is what he covers in the original autobiography. And it's really Franklin, the local citizen, a successful businessman, an inventor, and a civic-minded individual. And then he heads to England as the colonial agent for Pennsylvania and later several other colonies. And that's where he becomes a national and international figure. That's what makes him famous. And if it wasn't for all of that, we probably wouldn't be reading the original autobiography. So it's kind of ironic in that sense. Well, as I read this, and as many of you have read the autobiography, you're naturally disappointed that he doesn't talk about the Declaration of Independence and how that transpired, how he became a revolutionary, because up to that point he's defending the British Empire. He considers himself a British citizen or a British subject. And it doesn't discuss his critical role of 9 years as ambassador to France. And it doesn't discuss the Constitutional Convention, where he played a critical role in getting everybody together and to compromise and come up with the Constitution. So that's part one. Part two is I'd say 20 years ago, I started collecting the papers of Benjamin Franklin. And these are all the papers, letters both from Franklin and to Franklin, his journal entries. He kept a journal from time to time, and his major papers and essays and so forth, all compiled at Yale University. And they've done 37 volumes. Well, as I was just kind of selectively going through these volumes, I made a great discovery that Franklin had basically completed his autobiography in his own words, with a few exceptions of some events that he didn't write about for whatever reason, such as his meeting with Voltaire in around 1785. But overall, he had basically written he had completed his autobiography. The problem was that in 1790, when he died, he was so busy with public affairs, and he was in such excruciating pain, primarily from a kidney stone, that he just ran out of time. And it was one of his great regrets that he never finished it. And the other thing that's interesting is that what was his modus operandi? Well, basically, Franklin said, I need to rely on my papers in Philadelphia to write my autobiography. So he was relying on that. And so I decided, well, let me take an attempt at putting this together, and using his same systematic approach, we have his papers, we have his letters, they're very autobiographical, let's see if it can be done. And I was delighted, and my publisher was delighted that I was actually able to put this together. Now, I will tell you that I came up against a couple of stumbling blocks. One was, and this is why I brought this one, this is the one that covers 1776. And it looks very thick. It's like 600 or 700 pages. So you would think in 600 or 700 pages that Franklin would say something about the Declaration of Independence. Well, guess what? There's nothing in there. He doesn't talk about it. One of the reasons he didn't talk about it is because these are secret sessions. And he always made a point of, I won't discuss this. It's a secret. So you can imagine my trying to put together the completed autobiography, and you have nothing to say about the most singular event in the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence. So how was I going to deal with this issue? Well, first of all, Jefferson wrote a letter to Franklin saying, Dr. Franklin, could you please peruse this draft of the Declaration of Independence that I have written and make a few changes? And so it was merely a fairly easy thing to do to use a similar language for Franklin, saying, Jefferson came to me and asked me to peruse this draft of the Declaration of Independence, and I made a few changes. We also have the original draft of the Declaration of Independence, and we have a clear area where Franklin made a significant change. What was that change? He made a one-word change in the Declaration of Independence that all of you are familiar with. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, is what Jefferson wrote. Franklin, in his left hand, and by the way, that's about the only thing I've inherited from Franklin, his left-handedness, he marked very boldly, scratched out sacred and undeniable, and wrote in self-evident. And why did he do this? Well, nobody knows, but we think it's because, as a child of the Enlightenment, he praised rational science over faith and revelation. One of the things I discovered in completing the Franklin's autobiography is became deeply religious at the end of his life. And this is something that most historians fail to recognize. And this is particularly evident in his speech to the Constitutional Convention, where he begs the delegates that we should open the session with prayer. And he says, the longer I live, the more I know that God governs in the affairs of men. And have we not seen occasion after occasion where Providence has intervened on our behalf for us to win the war? And they didn't adopt his resolution, but nevertheless, it's an indication that he went from being a deist to being a theist, a believer that God was active in our affairs. So I am under, I would think that Franklin, if he could relive his life, would have kept the original language. Frankly, I think Jefferson's language is better. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. I think it's much more powerful than self-evident. But you may disagree with me on that. Well, anyway, the other thing that Franklin didn't talk about was this period of time. He was so busy in 1776 that he didn't get a chance to write about how he felt about it until 2 years later. In 1778, he was sitting down with Arthur Lee one evening, and Arthur Lee was one of the commissioners in France with him. And he said that one evening he and Dr. Franklin sat around and reminisced for 2 hours on what had transpired during 1776. And Franklin says it was a miracle in human affairs that here was a country that had no national laws, no military, no money, and fighting the greatest military force in history. And so it was a miracle that they were able to put together laws and military and money and do all these things and have some success in winning this. So all of this I have included in Chapter 4, and all I did was say change it from Dr. Franklin said to I said. Everything else is clearly in the tone of voice that Franklin might have. The rest of the book is pretty much completely original source material. It is in Franklin's words. I didn't want to write an historical novel. I wanted this to be in Franklin's own words. And, you know, yeah, you can pick up anthologies of Franklin. You can lots of books have been, you know, Walter Isaacson has a book, an anthology called The Franklin Reader. But it just jumps around. There's no cohesion. You know, there's a letter here and a letter there. You don't get the feeling of a story. And I have to give credit to my wife, Joanne, who is really the co-editor of this book, because she was the one who really made it seamless. And the reviews that I've received from radio interviews and on Amazon.com, if you look at some of the reviews that are just starting to come out, I'm very pleased to see that people have sensed that this is a story and it's all in Franklin's words. Now, today, I am talking on the subject of Ben Franklin. Is he a conservative? Is he a libertarian? Or is he a radical Democrat? That's my basic theme. There's lots of different facets of Franklin's life, but I want to focus politically on his political philosophy in this presentation. So, what can we say about him? Well, first of all, Franklin would have disliked very much being labeled. He did not like political parties at all. When he met at the Constitutional Convention, as far as he was concerned, You were simply delegates from various colonies or states, the 13 states. You weren't Republicans. You weren't Democrats. You weren't Whigs. You weren't Federalists and Anti-Federalists. That kind of came out after the Constitution was put together. So Franklin really had a great disdain for party politics. So debates about whether he's Republican or Democrat, I think are going to really miss the point. Now, one of the things about Franklin that I really like is that he was an incurable optimist. He had a gift for prophecy, and he was very accurate. He, throughout, you'll discover in the completed autobiography that Franklin knew from the very beginning. He wrote letters saying, "We are going to win this war." And this was at a time when a lot of people had doubts about that. And second of all, once the war was won, Franklin was very upbeat about the future of America. He said, "This will be a great and mighty country." And so he, in many ways, was the father of American capitalism and America's growth machine, with his focus on industry, thrift, and prudence, and economy, frugality. These kind of principles, he believed, that apply not only for individuals, but for companies, business, as well as government. So there are many examples of where he would apply his business principles to government. Now, although not a churchgoer, Franklin supported a very practical religion. And this is a very important point, I think, regarding some of the debates that you see today. He favored good works and charity over simple faith and hope. Franklin was famous for engaging in innumerable civic and charitable causes throughout his adult life. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, a lot of times government and the UN and so on, they all talk about private-public cooperation, private-public cooperation. And that's kind of Franklin's approach to government. There was one occasion where he went to the government and said, to the government of Pennsylvania, and said, "We'd like to start our first hospital. Can you give us £2,000 for this purpose?" Of course, they said no. Then he said, he came back to him and said, "Well, what if I raise £2,000 from the public, from the private sector, in a sense? Would you match it?" And you see, then the government delegates, they went for that. And the reason they went for that was to say, well, that suggests there's a public support for this project. And so if you can raise the £2,000 from private citizens, then we'll match it. And he did that, and he did it very quickly. Franklin was a fundraiser par excellence. I don't think there's ever been a better fundraiser than Ben Franklin. So David Bowes, if you were alive today, that's the guy you need to use, although you've been pretty successful as it is. But all of us are in this arena of think tanks and tax-exempt organizations are always looking for fundraising. Let me give you the best example of this is Franklin during his time as ambassador to France. Basically, they had five commissioners that they appointed over the nine-year period, and only one of them could truly live up to the term diplomat, being diplomatic, and that was Franklin. Franklin was beloved by the French people, and he loved the French people. But that was not true of any of the other commissioners. I don't know what Congress was thinking, sending John Adams, who's obnoxious and disliked, as the saying, as 1776, the musical, points out. Same thing with the Lee brothers. Arthur Lee was, and William Lee, like Richard Henry Lee, were all very cantankerous, critical individuals who hated the French. Don't know why they were there. Franklin loved France, and he raised, some estimate, $1 billion in financial and military aid. And without that, without the French support, America could not have won this war. When Cornwallis looked out at Yorktown and saw all the French ships and the French troops, and the majority of troops were French, he capitulated. And that simply would not have happened without French support. And just as one example to show you how great Franklin was and why I think he's the co-father of this nation, Washington won the war at home, but Franklin won the war abroad. And just to give you an example of how good he was, there was one time where Congress, after several years of already giving millions and millions of livres, of the currency at the time, to the American cause, again, Congress went back, well, we've run out of money again. Please, I beg of you, Dr. Franklin, go back to the king, go back to Vergennes, the foreign minister, and ask for another 25 million livres. So reluctantly, Franklin goes back and very colorful phraseology writes the king and a king of France and through Vergennes asks for 25 million. A couple weeks later, Vergennes comes back, his head down. He says, I'm sorry to report, Dr. Franklin, that we're broke. And not only are we broke, but you're broke. And your credit is not worth anything. Why bother loaning you any money at all? And then he pauses, and then Vergennes says, however, because you are so beloved by the King of France, he has decided to give you, not loan you, but give you 6 million livres. Now, I don't know, for any of you who have had fundraising experience, to be able to do that to an individual who is broke and still giving you money is truly remarkable. And we have really underestimated Franklin's role in the American Revolution. And I think it's really, really critical. Now, on the dark side, Franklin was an opportunist, no question about that. He constantly sought government privilege. For him and his relatives, nepotism was very common among Franklin and others. He printed currency, the banknotes for several states, which he called a very profitable job. In 1753, he landed a lucrative position as postmaster of North America. He got his son William appointed royal governor of New Jersey. And he sought a land grant from Ohio for many years, finally denied. So only after the American Revolution did Franklin finally decide that corporate welfareism wasn't for him. And he said, I am of the opinion that almost any profession a man has been educated in is preferable to an office held at pleasure, that is, in the public. And the rift between father and son as a result of this is one reason Franklin often said there never was a good war or a bad peace. Now, most of us who look at that statement realize that it may be the former may be true, but the latter is definitely not true, because there can be many examples of a bad peace. But anyway, the war destroyed forever his relationship with his son William, and a lot of historians have criticized Franklin for not reconciling with his son. But imagine this: if you had appointed your son to be royal governor of New Jersey, and then that government turns against you, brutalizes your all your friends and citizens and so forth, and you're simply to turn the other cheek and forgive him when he himself says, if I had to do it over again, I would do the same thing. Now, I think Franklin is somewhat justified in that attitude. War to Franklin was a necessary evil. The other thing that he didn't like war is because he was not able to pursue his practical inventions and scientific pursuits. What were Franklin's politics? First of all, he was no social libertarian, and this kind of surprises a lot of people considering what we know about Franklin, his lifestyle with the French ladies in Paris, his frequenting the salacious Hellfire Club in London, his reading of books in the nude. One of the things I discovered in completing the autobiography is that he wrote stern letters to his daughter Sally, chastising her for wanting to wear the latest fashions during the war. He refused to buy his grandson, Benny, a gold watch while in France. He dressed plainly and constantly preached economy. And one of the things I discovered is you read this wonderful language about Franklin criticizing the growth of taverns in Philadelphia upon his return in England. Now, that's not kind of a libertarian view, I would think. The other thing, he hated mobs of all kinds. He criticizes this rabble rouser about John Wilkes, and you know he's usually a libertarian hero, John Wilkes, but he really disliked all of that was going on at the time. Also, he was a radical Democrat. He supported a unicameral legislature. He was a true Democrat. He believed one man, one vote. One man, one woman, one black. You know, he had no problem with everyone voting. And this was at a time when democracy had real negative connotations, because democracy back then meant the rule of the mob and the rule of the common man. And the common man is ignorant. So Franklin was very much a Democrat in that respect, but he was also a diplomat, and so he compromised. He suggested the compromise, one of several, at the Constitutional Convention to bring together the Senate, represented by the states, and the House of Representatives by population. But if he had his druthers, it would have been just a House of Representatives, unicameral legislature, and it would be based representation based solely on population. He makes a very interesting statement that sounds very libertarian, however, politically. A virtuous and industrious people may be cheaply governed. So if you ask yourself, are we cheaply governed today? And most people, and I've asked a lot of people across the political center, Republicans or Democrats, are we cheaply governed? And every one of them says, no, we're expensively governed. So that brings it back on us as a people, though. How virtuous and how industrious are we? He was a disciple of Adam Smith and free trade. He was enamored with laissez-faire policies. He speaks out eloquently in favor of laissez-faire, let us alone. And what should the government policy be? Not to govern strictly, he said. He has this wonderful article that he wrote for a London paper defending the rich. He said, who wrote the poor laws, the welfare system of the time? Well, it wasn't the poor people, it was rich people. And then he lists all the things that rich people have done for the poor. It's a really delightful article that is in the completed autobiography. He worries about the incentives for the poor and how they'd be affected by a welfare system. He opposed a minimum wage law that was being discussed at that time. He wrote in favor of free immigration and fast population growth. He was no Malthusian. He rejected any form of state religion or mandatory religious oaths of office. However, as I pointed out, he would advocate, this is where he would disagree with the ACLU today, I would presume, he was very much in favor of having prayers in public places, as long as it didn't favor one religion over another. He was no free-thinking anarchist. In economics, this is one area in economics I think you'll find interesting. He favored paper money in a time when many of the founding fathers were very much opposed to paper money. He owned 10 shares in the Bank of North America, and he seemed to be quite favorable toward the Hamiltonian plan of a national bank. His likeness on the $100 bill of an irredeemable American paper currency would please his vanity, especially being 100 times worth more than Washington. Although he never said anything negative about Washington. About the only criticism he had of any of the founding fathers was John Adams. And their rift was pretty well known, which again is one reason why he hated war so much, because he used to be friends with John Adams. He argued in favor of free education for youth, and he believed government should play a role in dispelling public fads and superstitions. So again, that sounds more conservative than libertarian. And here's the other thing that libertarians would have a hard time with, the Lockean trilogy of life, liberty, and property. Franklin, there's several statements that Franklin makes in the completed autobiography, where he joins Jefferson in the theme of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, leaving out the third trilogy of property. And in fact, Franklin writes at one point that property is the creature of society and can be legitimately taxed for civil society. And he says he's quite critical of Americans unwilling to pay their fair share of what he calls society's dues. Finally, Franklin would be critical of business. He would probably be critical of Milton Friedman's view business should only be in the focusing on making of profits rather than being very civically minded. And Franklin, of course, was very much an advocate that business should be involved. And he, of course, helped establish insurance company, Philadelphia's own hospital, library, and militia. What kind of epitaph would Franklin have on his gravestone? Well, he toyed with several ideas in his lifetime, but the one that I think he would be most proud of is the one where he said, "I'd rather it be known he lived usefully rather than he died rich." Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. We'll open it up to questions now. Raise your hand, and we'll bring a microphone around to you. And, Mark, I think you can just stay there at the podium and
okay.
Call on questioners. In the back there.
Which Franklin should we take as our role model? Early to bed, early to rise? Or living in France, very late to bed, very late to rise, and living dissolutely?
Well, it sounds like you've read the completed autobiography. Because one of the things that I discovered, and I put it in the completed autobiography, is that Franklin changed in many ways in the last part of his life. He not only changed his religious views from being a deist to a theist, but he kind of rejected out of hand the early to bed, early to rise mentality. In fact, that whole essay that he writes about daylight savings time, which is all tongue-in-cheek, by the way, him being the father of daylight savings time is a little bit suspect. He did suggest it, but it was all it was purely a satire. On the French people who didn't know that the sun rises at 6 in the morning. And so he really pokes fun of the French people for staying late into the night partying, and Franklin was very much a part of that, and then waking up around noontime. And this is one thing the commissioners, John Adams was furious about this. Adams, very... puritanical, he and his wife coming over, Abigail, and they attend one of these parties that Franklin's at, and they're just totally disgusted with Franklin and the French women sitting on his lap and kissing him and engaging in the most salacious activities. They had a hard time figuring that out, and of course they complained about Franklin getting up very late, and his books were in disarray. The finances were in disarray. But, you know, understand, here's a man who's now in his 70s. I did discover along those lines another interesting thing, and there are several evidences of that in the completed autobiography, is that he did have a very strong libido. It was still very much there in the 70s. So you'll have to read between the lines in some of the statements that Franklin makes there.
What was your biggest surprise in completing this work?
I can just repeat the question. What was the biggest surprise in completing this work? Well, I actually wrote a list of about 7 surprises, and I think the biggest surprise from my point of view was this critical role that Franklin played in raising the money for the American cause. And the fact that all these other commissioners that had been selected were just weren't diplomatic. And John Adams was sent to Holland, and then after the war in England as a diplomat, and that fit him a lot better than the French. You know, he tried to learn French, but he had a very difficult time, both he and his wife, as far as that's concerned. And I just don't believe the money could have been raised. And the other thing I discovered was, in that regard, Franklin was the one responsible for bankrupting the French government. And, I mean, if you raise what are estimated to be close to $1 billion, or multi-millions, and where the French were running out of money, they had a scarcity of money that they were talking about, they had a banking crisis, one major French bank failed. This, in a sense, is what brought on the French Revolution. And the French failed miserably in following Frank. In the book, you'll see in some of the later chapters, Franklin's own view of how do you finance a war. And he was really angry with Congress that they wouldn't issue interest-bearing banknotes, which was very common back then, but Congress didn't want to do it. And he said, and not only that, but you should make the interest be paid in gold and silver. So he's a bit of a hard money man in that respect. But his role in a positive way of helping financing the American war effort, that is a real underappreciated aspect of Franklin. And nobody at their time appreciated Franklin in that regard. In fact, when Franklin died, the Senate, which was under the control of the Lees and John Adams, didn't even do a eulogy for Franklin. They waited a year later, and then William Smith, an enemy, got up and gave the eulogy. And here's what he said in his eulogy. He said, "All of you well know Dr. Franklin's accomplishments, so why bother telling you?" That's how he started his eulogy. So that was a pretty major discovery. I should also mention, thinking of this area of inflation, Franklin has this wonderful language about how wonderful hyperinflation can be, even though he's against it. He talks about how it financed the war, and we had no credit whatsoever, but Europeans were dumb enough to buy our paper. It's wonderful language about the case for hyperinflation, if you want to read that. Yes. Let's do Margie first. Ladies first.
Mark, I've heard the debate over the national symbol for the new country of the United States, and I remember hearing that there was a big debate over whether the bird should be the eagle or the turkey, I think Franklin was said to advocate. But I think in your completed autobiography, there was a story of another animal that he was advocating as a symbol that I thought might be fun to tell.
Yeah, you're right. Most of you know, if you've seen the musical 1776, you know where Franklin talks about how he has great disdain for the eagle as a symbol because he's a predator, and it's not an appropriate symbol for a country that should be peaceful. And that reminds me, by the way, of another great quote. There are two great quotes that come out of the completed autobiography that I've never seen anywhere else that I discovered in doing this work. One is, "A virtuous and industrious people may be cheaply governed," which everybody nods their head on. But let me give you the second one, see if you all nod your head on this one. "The policy of America is to have commerce with all and war with none." Much more controversial, but a few applaud in the audience here. David, I would think you would applaud to that.
I applaud it, and I note that Washington and Jefferson said virtually the same thing.
Yes, that's right. In fact, in Washington's farewell address, a lot of times we focus just on the foreign entangling alliances and that sort of thing of Washington's farewell address, but read the next paragraph where he says, "But what America should do on a positive basis is increase commercial relations with each country." And Franklin said this, I think, better 18 years before Washington did. "The policy of America is commerce with all and war with none." But getting back to Margie's question, there's this anonymous piece that Franklin wrote for a Philadelphia newspaper. We didn't know for many years whether it was authored by Franklin or not, but now most historians agree that it was. And that is, the rattlesnake should be the symbol of America, because it doesn't strike you unless you strike it. So, and at the time he was looking at this rattlesnake, it had 13 rattles on it. He counted them. He said, oh, there's 13 rattles. This is definitely the symbol for America. And it won't be bothered unless you bother it. So that was pretty good, symbolism, I think. Yes, and in the back there, yeah.
How late was he in England up to 1775? And when did this famous bear baiting, this thing where he was assaulted
in the cockpit,
occur?
Yeah.
Because I've gotten the idea that that was the thing that made him become a supporter of American independence.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because I noticed there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently, or just a couple days ago, during on Franklin's 300th birthday, which said that Franklin came late into the game in advocating separation. And this is another discovery that I made in the completed autobiography. Franklin wrote as early as 1771, and I believe that is earlier than many of the other founding fathers, in 1771, saying, we have sown the seeds of disunion, and it cannot be put back together. And yet, he always was hopeful that we could be part, maintain this part of the British Empire. The cockpit event where in the Hutchinson letters controversy, and I don't want to get into all the particulars of it, but Franklin was in the cockpit, which is a place in London where in Henry VIII's time they had a cockpit for fighting of bird fighting or cockfighting. So it was in this place that for over an hour Franklin stood in front of the House of Lords and was viciously, personally attacked by the top British brass. And this is what was he was threatened with arrest. And it was at this point that Franklin realized that everything has been severed. And so he made his plans to leave. It took him another year or so before he left. He left in early 1775, and when he arrived, he had found out about Lexington and Concord, the shot heard around the world, and the war was on. So he arrived just back in time. And you look at Franklin's life, and it's just remarkable how he was always there for the signing of all these documents, and the only document he didn't sign, but he wrote the original draft for, was the Articles of Confederation. Another question. Yes.
Yes. Okay. I've read that Franklin had something in the order of 20 children outside of marriage. Did you find any evidence of this?
Okay, regarding Franklin and women, first of all, I have found over the years probably more false accusations about Franklin than any other. Franklin, as far as we know, had only one illegitimate child, and that's William. However, William had an illegitimate child named Temple. Temple had an illegitimate child. And we don't even know that maybe there's a name. I don't know who the name is. So there's this kind of tradition of promiscuity in his family, and that has caused all these rumors to go around about Franklin siring many illegitimate children. I should tell you that my own direct ancestry is through Louis Bache, grandson of Franklin. My direct relationship to them is also through an illegitimate son. He had two illegitimate children. So So this is the basis of the rumor. Jefferson said that when Franklin was around women, he went into a frenzy. And interesting term that he would use. But Franklin was also loved by he was the only founding father that I'm aware of, the major founding fathers, who was very approachable, very nice guy, whether women or men. He just socially, he just got along with everyone. He was not a very good public speaker, by the way. He hated to give public speeches, but privately, behind the scenes, he would tell a story, he would have a glass of wine, a Madeira wine, or what have you. I understand you have Madeira wine today in honor of Franklin. Is this correct for at the luncheon?
I'm not sure that it is. probably would have been a good idea.
Ben would be very disappointed. So anyway, that's really the story with Franklin. But the other thing that I think is often a misconception is that he treated his wife badly. And a lot of the historians have made this accusation. It is true that Franklin and his wife were separated for the last 15 years of their lives. And it was because Franklin was in England as colonial agent and his wife was over in Philadelphia. But as much as Franklin coaxed his wife to come with him, she adamantly refused to go across the oceans. She was just really adverse to that, just as some people don't want to get on an airplane today. And so their relationship, while their letters are very affectionate toward each other, they became fewer, and their relationship definitely drew apart. But I don't really blame either one on this. He does have numerous letters, as you will see in the completed autobiography, of Franklin's love for his children and grandchildren. I mean, he was so despondent over his son William not joining him on that cause. But he died a very happy man. He repeatedly refers to the love he has for his grandchildren, he has a whole flock of grandchildren around him at the time of his death. So I don't think it's fair to accuse him of being the lecher and that sort of thing that you often hear about. Yes.
You mentioned Franklin's criticism of the number of taverns, and I know the Cato Institute has been very critical of the prohibitionist approach to drug policy. I'm wondering if he ever addressed this, or can you infer from his writings what he would have thought about the proper government approach to personal use of recreational drugs?
Okay, now this a question like this, you only have indirect evidence. There's the conservative side where he was rather critical of tavern. He in Poor Richard's Almanac, there are a number of statements, drink not to elevation. And he was critical of people who got drunk. There's in the autobiography, there's the story of when he's over in London at a time when the common workman that he worked with at the print shop there in London said, well, strong beer makes you strong. The more you drink during work, the better off you are. And Franklin saw the stupidity of that, made it known to all of them, and drank water. As to whether someone would have the freedom, personal freedom or not, to use these things, it is interesting that Franklin, in the last year of his life, did take opium. And you'll see that in the book where he says, I took opium because I was in excruciating pain from the stone, the kidney stone. So that was the painkiller of the day. This is at a time when there were no illegal drugs. So other than the fact that he used it and he was glad that it was available, even though it made him very skin and bones, it was really in the last few years of life, but it gave him the pleasure. So I would think he would favor certainly medical marijuana, which is meant to soothe the pain when you're dying of cancer or some other disease. I suspect he would favor that. But these kind of questions are always problematic. We're not really sure unless he's standing here today.
In the back. In the back. Way in the back.
Way in the back.
Yeah, I've heard that you talk of the many documents that Franklin signed, and do you think he would be upset at society today, the way that with society today, the way that our government has moved away from and is cheating people out of their rights with unsigned documents and court orders? And right now we have a Supreme Court that 90% of the alleged denial orders come out of the Supreme Court with an unsigned rubber stamp. We have courts of appeals that have 90% of the denial orders are unsigned and rubber stamped. Do you think you would be upset at this time about this?
There's a great statement in the completed autobiography by Franklin, which I felt was extremely important to put in the edited volume. And that is where he says, "I'm extremely jealous of the rights of the American people. And any infringement on those rights makes my blood boil." So that's pretty hard terms. That's another great quote that we ought to bring up all the time. So you can have statements like that that you can use to support what you're saying. It's just that it's impossible to say exactly how he would view these things, because you also have the rattlesnake symbol, which you can use to justify the war on terrorism, couldn't you? Because we were stepped on, all right? So we have the right to strike back. So I can see the defenders of the war on terrorism using that as an example. But we really don't know. We play this game a lot with all the founding fathers. Whatever our view is, we search and we find something that supports our view from the founding fathers. And I think we have to be very careful I think we need to be circumspect. And I'll give you one other example. Franklin waxes eloquently about inviting strangers to our country in favor of free immigration. No restrictions at all. Come one, come all. Well, that made a lot of sense in a country that was relatively poorly populated, and they were looking for people to fill up the country and to make it the great country that it is. But can you say, well, therefore, Franklin is pure libertarian, open border policy today? I don't think you can make that statement, because maybe the circumstances are different. Franklin was always adjusting his... I've already mentioned how he changed his mind as he got older on his religious views. The war really affected his religious views. His attitudes about industry and thrift. There's this delightful story where he's sitting around with his family, his daughter, her husband, and seven grandchildren, and they're playing cards. He liked to play chess, but this is the one example where he's playing cards. And he said, "I thought for a minute how, gee, this is a waste of time. And then I let that fleeting thought disappear, and he says, cut the cards again. Let's play another game."
Let me take the prerogative of asking the last question. If I haven't already read the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, do you think I ought to read that before I read the completed autobiography?
Well, David, I think you do. You should read the story from beginning to end. So pick up a copy of the autobiography. And in fact, I will tell you about another book, not published by Regnery. Maybe it should have been. But there's a book called Ben Franklin, the Original Entrepreneur, and it's subtitled Franklin's Autobiography for Modern Times. And it's been translated into the 21st century. It's the original autobiography in 21st century language. And it's put together by Blaine McCormick, who's at Baylor Business School. And he, like me, has regretted the fact that the autobiography is not as popular as it used to be in the 19th century. What I recommend is you read the autobiography. It's a wonderful story. It's an inspiring story. And I should say, regarding my own, and I think it'd be worth, they belong together. They really do. They belong together. And there's a natural division between these two books. Okay, this, the original autobiography, is the story of Franklin, rags to riches, getting going in life, achieving success, and as a printer, as an inventor. And then when he achieves that success, what does he do with his money? He does good. He lives usefully, like he says in his epitaph. And that's what this book is about. This, then you shift gears. There's almost a natural division between the two books. It's almost as if Franklin meant to die and not finish it. Because in finishing it, you see a natural break. And what is this? Going to England, being a national figure, and then an international figure when he goes to Paris and he participates in the greatest revolution of mankind. Thank you very much. Out on audio tape, too, so you can listen to it as you're driving along home.
Thank you, Mark. I want to thank Mark for being here. We thank a lot of the founders at the Cato Institute. The completed autobiography of Benjamin Franklin is available at Amazon, laissez-faire books, and all fine bookstores. And, of course, it's available right outside, and you can get it signed on your way up to lunch. Thanks for being here.
With a rare stamp, Franklin stamp.